Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
The text that I'm going to draw from in this first talk, mainly the idea of a university, a little bit from the Grammar of Assent, and actually the end, when I talk about the Grammar of Assent, will take us a little bit back to the differences between Aquinas and Newman on approaches to the existence of God. I want to say a little bit about that. So those two books, mainly, and then there are two sermons that I'll be drawing from. One is Intellect, Instrument of Religious Training, which was a sermon that Newman gave at the opening of the Catholic University in Dublin on the Feast of St. Monica. And then he has another sermon, Personal Influence, The Means of Propagating the Truth. So I'll be, if you're interested in which text, it's those two books and those two sermons. I was thinking a little bit about Newman's idea of a university still is cited as one of the premier works ever, particularly in the English language, on the nature of education, and particularly liberal education. I think those of us who have grown up in a period, which would be you all, not me, where we've seen a lot of smaller Catholic institutions flourish around the ideals of liberal education, and we've seen classical education at the primary and secondary level in both Protestant and Catholic circles flourishing, might think that we're in this movement, we're returning to something that was common in America. Not the case. Really not the case. The dominant, it's not surprising if you think about America, the dominant models of education in America come out of Franklin, Ben Franklin, and John Dewey. And Dewey gives us what we've had for a long time in most of our public schools, which is a focus on training people for social progressivism, so that education is about everything, it seems, except the content of the curriculum. And Franklin gives us a much more utilitarian model of education, where it's about jobs. I recall a comment from Rubio a few years ago where he said, "We've got way too many philosophers in this country. We need more welders. People should quit majoring in philosophy." I don't know if you can major in welding, but so this utilitarian focus, and given the cost of education today, there's something to that. It's, as I was thinking through this, it's so weird that a lot of the kind of liberal education, the notion, and this is, Newman was not really a great books education guy, although he took a number of great books very seriously. But what he shares with the movement in the second half of the 20th century into our own century is an emphasis upon an education that is desirable for its own sake, where learning is at least a limited end for its own sake. And that conception of education, it flourished off and on at Columbia and at the University of Chicago in the early half of the century. Actually, there's one person whom I think touched all of this in it at the two St. John's campuses in Annapolis and Santa Fe, the kind of classical great books, and Thomas Aquinas College, sort of Catholic version of those where I had my first teaching job. But the one person who runs through this whole narrative is a secular Jew who aspired to be a journalist, Mortimer Adler. It's probably a name that most of you don't know. But Adler studied at Columbia in the 20s and read Aquinas, and converted not long before his death at almost 100 years old. My mentor, Ralph McInerney at Notre Dame, who was, in addition to being a great Thomist philosopher, also wrote lots and lots of mystery novels, for which he had many puns for titles. He had a series that were set at Notre Dame. One of them was called On This Rockney, and the lack of the Irish. When Mortimer died and they had become friends, he wrote a piece called Memento Mortimer. But he noted in there that Time magazine at a certain point had called Mortimer Adler a peeping Thomist, because he was a guy who had, on the outside, just kept being interested in Aquinas. He wrote a bunch of books. His first book that he wrote was How to Read a Book. And I think One of the reviews said, before he writes another book, he ought to read a book about how to write a book. It's kind of harsh critique. But Adler wasn't, he was at Chicago, Columbia, Chicago, and then he was at, involved in St. John's, and ended up a secular Thomist for most of his life, and then did end up becoming Catholic not long before he died. So it's hard to find public intellectuals of the level of Newman who have written about liberal education in America who articulate it as clearly as Newman does. So I want to start out by, I want to talk about what education is for Newman, what it's not, and then I want to talk about, even at its best, what some of the potential problems with liberal education is. So Newman's understanding of liberal education, if I had to put it in one sentence, it's about the university as the locus of liberal education, because I think you could, and I'll make an argument later, that liberal education could be construed much more comprehensively. But the university part of liberal education focuses on the pursuit of truth in its complexity and its unity. And both are important. And as Father mentioned this morning, one of the wonderful things about talking about Newman is you get to read these amazing sentences, which you're right. If you put that in a sophomore paper, you have a professor that writes a run-on sentence on the in the margins. This is a short one by comparison. That alone is liberal knowledge, which stands on its own pretensions, which is independent of sequel, expects no compliment, refuses to be informed, as it is called, by any end, or absorbed into any art, in order duly to present itself to our contemplation. The most ordinary pursuits have this specific character if they are self-sufficient and complete. There's, as you often find, you're much more widely read in Newman, but you often find, in addition to modern interlocutors, you find Aristotle showing up in a number of places, and that notion of ends that are complete and self-sufficient is right out of the first book of the Ethics, when Aristotle's talking about the end of human life. Newman is insisting, to use the language of Alistair MacIntyre, that education has goods internal to it, and that success is not to be measured merely by its extracurricular payoff. That's a line from a book by Stanley Fish, one-time deconstructionist Milton scholar who then saw the light and gave up on deconstruction, and wrote a book against kind of progressive models of education in the university that was titled Save the World on Your Own Time. The pursuit of knowledge for its own sake is not fulfilled in the accumulation of a series of isolated true propositions. Even within particular branches of knowledge, particular disciplines, if we exclude relevant perspectives on an object or a subject matter, we will attain for Newman only a partial and imperfect view. So we need to see things, a passage I'll read later, from multiple sides. We need to go round an object and see it in all of its complexity. We also need to integrate what we are learning in various spheres into some sort of unified whole. For Newman, this means cultivating both enlargement or expansion and what he calls the philosophical habit. Capaciousness is not enough, nor is detailed specialized knowledge. Newman identifies the active disposition of comparing, organizing, and integrating as the philosophical habit. The philosophical habit here for Newman is not primarily a particular subject matter or discipline, like you might go and take a course in philosophy. It's something that has to inform your education in all its parts. There's a great book by Fred Aquino, who's now at, who's a Protestant who works on Newman. He works a lot with Logan Gage, who's a Catholic at chair of the philosophy department at Franciscan. They do a lot of writing together on Newman. But the best book on this account of the mind, I think, is Aquino's The Integrative Habit. It's a very good book. What Newman has in mind here is something like what Bernard Lonergan calls the ability to ask the next relevant question. We know this about this and that about that. How do we put these together? How do we extend the knowledge further? As Notre Dame Newman scholar Mary Catherine Tillman observes, this is an account of knowledge that resists reductionism and never yields to final paraphrase. Newman also sees, and I'll say more about this in the second talk, this enlargement of mind, and here I think it goes beyond university education, as a deeply personal matter. We aim, Newman says, to make the objects of our knowledge subjectively our own and digest what we receive into the substance of our previous state of thought. Okay, so that's a short description of what it is. Knowledge and the pursuit of truth and its complexity and unity, with the intellect having as a proper end the contemplation of the truth that's discovered. What it's not. It's not a lot of things. Education's direct business, Newman writes, is not to steel the soul against temptation or to console it in affliction, any more than to set the loom in motion or to direct the steam carriage, be it ever so much the means or the condition of both material and moral advancement. Still, taken by and in itself, it as little mends our hearts as it improves our temporal conditions. So what does Newman have in mind as an alternative to the claim that knowledge is its own end? Newman fends off, I think, at least four rival views: career advancement, religious piety, moral formation, and preparation for civic life. He's going to argue for a deep connection between religious formation and education. I'll spell that out later. But as the proper internal object of university disciplines, it is not to be initially subordinated to career advancement, religious piety, moral formation, or preparation for civic life. Anti-intellectualism, it turns out, can take many forms. We're perhaps most familiar with the careerist instrumentalization of education, which was not foreign to Newman, especially in the Irish setting of a very impoverished and ill-educated community that was concerned with even reaching the lower middle class in Ireland. Of course, this sort of instrumentalization can occur at any time and in any place where education provides some sort of path to a career. In the Irish setting, Newman is concerned not only with the desire for career advancement, but also with the desire of what he takes to be a goal of Irish prelates. And here comes a sentence with a lot of unfortunate alliteration. To have a population of peasants ruled patriotically, ruled by a patriotic priesthood patriarchically. As I said, that's a sentence with a lot of unhappy alliteration. University, Newman says, is a direct preparation for the world. You might think he's taking back some of what he said elsewhere, but it is not a convent, it's not a seminary. His main concession that he makes to the instrumentalist impulse is, if a practical end must be assigned, I say it is that of training good members of society. Its art is the art of social life, and its end is fitness for the world. Now, Newman is in fact quite happy to allow for all sorts of practical goods to arise from a liberal education. He included a business school in his model, so he's not against practical aims. As he observes, though the useful is not always good, the good is always useful. Here, I think implicitly, there's an Aristotelian antecedent going on, which is that early in the Ethics, Aristotle talks about different types of goods. Some are merely means. Some are only ends, like contemplation. That is an end in itself. What says at the beginning of the Metaphysics that one of the things that marks the superiority of contemplation is its uselessness, meaning it cannot be subordinated to any other end. But then Aristotle has a third category: goods that are ends in one respect that can nonetheless contribute to all sorts of other goods. And that's what he's drawing upon here. Indeed, in one of his opening speeches to students at the newly founded university in Dublin, he begins by noting and approving of the fact that the students have come to the university mainly in the hope of receiving a practical education that will fit them for careers. But he goes on to talk about the education they will have, an education not leading directly to this or that career path, but one that will make them men and fit them to take up any profession they happen to choose. As is true even in his more theoretical modes, so too here, Newman is a careful rhetorician. He's not a sophist. He's matching the content, his substantive content, to his audience. More interesting than Newman's resistance to the instrumentalization of learning for career, religion, or civic life is his separating of knowledge off from moral virtue. Knowledge is one thing, virtue is another. I first read Newman at an all-boys Catholic high school here in Hyattsville, Damantha, in my senior year in an English literature class, and we read this passage from Newman's Idea of a University. Knowledge is one thing, virtue is another. The supposition that intellectual training by itself can make one virtuous is an illusion. And here, I can't help but go back to Aristotle again. Aristotle warns in the opening of the Ethics, students should not study ethics thinking that a knowledge of virtue, a book knowledge of virtue, will make them virtuous. Aristotle tells people to go away who want to take refuge in theory. That view is likely to make the readers of the book worse. If you think that reading the book is going to make you better, it's going to make you worse, as readers would be tempted to equate their knowledge with virtue itself and fail to attend to the actions and practices that would habituate their own character in the direction of virtue. I think there are very interesting things to be said in light of what Newman and Aristotle are saying here about the whole project of character education, which has certainly a lot of good things to it, but there also can be a confusion about this. And here's why, even especially apart from our Catholic setting, Newman was really concerned with what he took to be an insidious version of this error in his own time. One that elevates this from a mistake of an individual, I'll read this book and become good, or at least impress people with how much I know about temperance and courage and justice. It elevates it from an individual mistake to an error in forming an entire curricular vision. Paul Shrimpton has a really nice book on Newman's University, Oxford, and Dublin, The Making of Men, it's called. And he says this, the whole foundation of Bentham's Utilitarian University College in London was premised on the idea that knowledge does make human beings better morally. As early as the 1830s, Newman was a consistent critic of this fallacy, of the march of the mind. These theorists, according to Newman, are caught in the grips of a theory about the power of theory. They suppose that our true excellence comes not from within, but from without. Not wrought out through personal struggle and suffering, but following upon a passive exposure to influences over which we have no control. Newman is appalled, and here we come back to the problem of evil. Newman is appalled at the naivete about what he calls at one point the enormities of evil. The theoretical view of the power of theory to counter evil ignores the need for moral struggle. It ignores the human vulnerability to self-deception, and it ignores moral blindness. In a famous passage, he writes, "Quarry the granite rock with razors, or moor the vessel with a thread of silk. Then may you hope with such keen and delicate instruments as human knowledge and human reason to contend against those giants, the passion and pride of men." This passage, which gets to the core of his resistance to the notion that academic education can supply moral virtue, needs to be read alongside the statement much later in the Idea, "The world is content with setting right the surface of things. The church aims at regenerating the very depths of the heart." Newman's insistence on these distinctions and his wariness about the role of moral formation in the academic sphere does not mean that he ignored the question of moral and spiritual formation. And I'll come to this in greater detail in my next lecture. But Newman basically sees a need for two models of education. One is a university model and one is a collegiate model. How Shrimpton writes, Newman was wondering, how can a university have a rich and full life? What needs to be put in place to foster not just intellectual knowledge, but corporate and individual well-being? Here, Newman focuses on the pastoral dimension of collegiate life. He thinks that residential collegiate living is the place where character formation chiefly occurs. The university, through scholarly professors, is the vehicle of progress or movement. By contrast, the college, through tutors, provides order or stability, and most importantly, what Newman calls the personal influence of the tutor or teacher on the student. The professorial system with famous teachers has the power to collect students who seek out great minds. Having brought them together, it is, however, impotent to preserve and edify them. It fulfills the strict idea of a university and is sufficient for its being, but not sufficient for well-being. Colleges constitute, for Newman, the integrity of the university. Each model has its defects. The collegiate model, whose virtues I have just mentioned, tends towards self-containment and insularity. Its vices, Newman says, are indolence and indifference to the wider world. The university, by contrast, assumes a public character. It is a source of intellectual movement, yet its dangers are stark. An academical system without the personal influence of teachers upon pupils is an Arctic winter. It will create an icebound, petrified, cast iron university and nothing else. Newton advocates a kind of hybrid model that would unite excellences of opposite kinds. This is something that I see in a number of places in Newman, where there are strengths and defects of different models, and he wants to correct one by the other. So partly what I said earlier about integration is important, but it's also important that complexity be kept. If you have premature integration, you can do as much damage as having complexity that dissolves into bits and pieces. In certain institutions, you need creative tensions. Okay, so Newman posits a distinction between knowledge and virtue. Good sense is not conscience. That's very important. Good sense is not conscience. Refinement is not humility. Lore is largeness and justness of view, faith. Philosophy, however enlightened, however profound, gives no command over the passions, no influential motives, no vivifying principles. Liberal education makes not the Christian. What does it make? It makes what Newman calls the gentleman, who has good sense, refinement, largeness and justice of view, and deep philosophical training. So it is not the case that the cultivation of the intellect in the university. So just to back up for a second, if Newman says it's not the direct aim of university education to form character, and here he's following Aristotle, then you might think that the university on its own would produce something that's morally neutral, but that's not the case. There is a distinct character type that Newman calls the gentleman that emerges from the proper formation to a university, a character type about which Newman is ambivalent. He states explicitly at one point an idea. This model partly assists and partly distorts the development of the Catholic. And here's how he spells out the problems with producing gentlemen from a moral and spiritual point of view, moral and theological. He says there's a radical difference of this mental refinement from genuine religion, in spite of the seeming relationship. Knowledge, and here we come to his concerns about it, viewed as knowledge, exerts a subtle influence in throwing us back on ourselves and making us our own center and our minds the measure of all things. This is a vice of academics. I think those of us who have worked around and in universities know that this is something that, it's why very few academics can see anything beyond their own discipline, and indeed often can't see anything beyond their own subspecialty within their own discipline. I have a friend I won't name. He's taught at a number of great Catholic colleges, now at Assumption, who's in administration. And there's a, you all are too young to know the sitcom Seinfeld, but there's one where the phrase delicate geniuses is used repeatedly. And he, when he's dealing with faculty, he says, I got too many delicate geniuses on the faculty here. More seriously and more broadly, which makes it difficult for faculty to understand how things outside of their own department work. It's amazing how, as I say this as someone who spent a lot of time in administration, it's amazing to me how little faculty actually understand of how the institutions they're part of are run. The deeper problem, though, I think with this is a great deal of learning makes you comfortable with what you think now. And it makes you very comfortable with the standards that you've always used to determine true and false, what's significant and what isn't. We all have this, right? This is not just a vice of academics. We all fall into this. We get habituated to being comfortable with, and we're simply dismissive of things. Oh, I know what that's about. I'm not thinking about that. You should notice that I don't talk here about this in any length, but I think they're actually within Newman's account of the natural telos of the mind, there are correctives to this, because Newman thinks that expansion and consideration of new objections, consideration of how this material relates to that, is always part of the mind, that until we die, and academics have a habit of truncating that. Their wonder is often very limited to a narrow segment of knowledge that they're focused on. Not always true, but it can be true. In the moral life, intellectual culture replaces fear of sin with shame. So we fear not sin, but we fear violating the code of what Newman says is fitting and becoming. Its final consequence is to transform key virtues and vices so that they become unrecognizable. The virtue of humility, crucial to self-knowledge and lots of other virtues for Christians, is transformed into modesty. Meanwhile, certain elements of the capital vice of pride become praiseworthy elements in a new virtue called self-respect. The attention shifts from the depths of the human soul to the surface appearances of social life. Newman says, if we will make light of what is deepest within us, nothing is left but to pay homage to what is more upon the surface. To seem becomes to be. What looks fair will be good. What causes offense will be evil. Virtue will be what pleases, vice. The upshot, as Alistair MacIntyre puts it in his great book on God, philosophy, and universities, is that even the best of university education may result in a peculiarly dangerous form of bad character. The potentially noxious result of intellectual cultivation, I would put this way, it is an aestheticization of the pursuit of the true and the good. We aestheticize it. Fear, Newman says, carries us out of ourselves, whereas shame may act upon us only within the round of our own thoughts. Such, I say, is the danger that awaits a civilized age. The tension between intellectual cultivation on the one hand and moral and religious formation on the other, that Newman notes here, recurs at the end, and I'll come back to that later. I think, to go back to Father's talk from this morning, Newman thought that one of the strengths of the argument from conscience is that it's universally evident. You don't have to be educated to feel qualms of guilt. You don't have to be educated to feel that you'd like to atone for or make just what you feel guilty about. And realizing how little power you have over that you can very easily start to long for some sort of redemption to come your way. I think what Newman is saying here with the gentleman, good sense replaces conscience, he sees in a civilized world, even in its civilized educational system, a dimming of conscience. Newman takes the experience of conscience to be a given, a self-evident starting point for a plausible argument, as Father Field said this morning, for the existence of God. He assumes the presence of God in our conscience and the universal experience as keen, this is him, I'm quoting him, as keen as our experience of bodily pain is the experience of conscience, of what we call a sense of sin and guilt. This sense of sin as of something not only evil itself, but an affront to the good God who is himself sanctity, truth, and love. And there's a lot to be worked out here, right? Conscience is often spoken of as a voice within, but Newman thinks it's a voice that comes from within but speaks in an authoritative way that can't just be me talking to myself, right? It's not just me acting as a coach to myself, as a life coach or something. It's actually got it's making an authoritative judgment over my acts, and that authority is much greater than my own individual capacities. Here's one of the differences, and in the time I have left, I want to try and talk about this question of the comparison of Newman and Aquinas. Aquinas treats Plato and Aristotle, especially Aristotle, as giving us a lot to work with and build upon in the way that grace works upon nature, faith builds upon reason. For Newman, there's an important sense in which the primitive religions of the human race prove to be more fruitful conversation partners. I don't mean that he's not interested in philosophy. I began by tying nearly every thesis in the first few pages of this to Aristotle. He goes so far as to say that his apologetic presupposes that his interlocutors share an experience of God as present in conscience, of God known as judge and redeemer, at least implicitly. Here he counters directly the modern, the assumption of the progressive nature of man, as he puts it. I should take my ideas of his religion from his initial, not his final testimony about the doctrines. And it may be urged that the religion of civilized times is quite opposite in character to the rites and traditions of barbarians. Among the barbarians, we find, in however a distorted and often a very distorted form, an awareness of the gravity and depth of human evil, a matter that modern Enlightenment philosophy and civilized education occlude from view. In the Thomistic tradition, much is made of the arguments through natural philosophy and metaphysics of arguments for the existence of God. Father Fields mentioned the five ways. Aquinas talks about these truths, puts them in a category of what he calls preambles of the faith. That is, these are truths such as the existence of God which are revealed, but in the best of circumstances can also be reached by human reason. And his view is that some philosophers have done this. So there's an overlap between revelation and reason. The rest of what revelation teaches concerning the Trinity, the Incarnation, the Church, sacraments, and redemption exceeds what philosophy can know. For Newman, natural religion has a decisive advantage. I think Newman also has preambles in mind, which I'll say a little bit more about in a moment. Natural religion has a decisive advantage over the conclusions of natural theology. Natural religion fosters an anticipation or a hope that a revelation will be given. The presentiment is founded on our sense, on the one hand, of the infinite goodness of God, and on the other, of our own extreme misery and need. Two doctrines which Newman says are the primary constituents of natural religion. In this relationship between natural and revealed religion, Newman finds a correlation or compatibility between nature and grace, reason and faith. Here he sounds like Thomas. Christianity does not supersede or contradicts nature. It recognizes and depends upon it. In contrast to the artificial religion of enlightened modernity, the Christian religion is a development, not a destruction, of the original state of human nature. It is a religion in addition to the religion of nature. And as nature has an intrinsic claim upon us to be obeyed and used, very Thomistic language, so what is over and above nature or supernatural must also bring with it valid testimonials of its own right to demand our homage. That's a pretty clear affirmation in his own form of the Thomistic teaching that grace does not destroy nature, but rather presupposes, elevates, and perfects it. Newman does think that he has an argument for the existence of God out of the reality of conscience. He qualifies it a bit, and I want to say two things after I read this. I don't think that Newman thinks that he can get all of the attributes in their fullness of God out of the argument from conscience. Because here's what he says. The God encountered in conscience has necessarily some of those special attributes which belong to the notion of God. He is invisible because he searches hearts. He is omniscient as far as man is concerned. He is, to our notions, omnipotent. If he can, after so many ages, at length hold the judgment when all sin shall be punished and virtue rewarded. We should notice the way he qualifies the attributes, omniscient as far as man is concerned, and to our notions, omnipotent. Any God worthy of worship will have to be more than simply a really powerful being within the universe. And Newman has other arguments for that. But I think here's where I want to suggest two ways in which Aquinas and Newman can be brought together on this. So just to be clear, when Aquinas talks about the preambles, these are like the things that are concluded to in the five ways, that there is a God who is infinite, who is eternal. You can get a bunch of negations out of knowing that God is an uncaused cause, right? You can just reel off a series of can't be material, can't be finite, etc. He calls these preambles because they're also revealed about God. These are things that God reveals about God to us. But they can be reached by natural reason. Therefore, they're preambles. Newman, I'm suggesting, has preambles through conscience, through primitive religion, as he calls it. The first thing I'd like to say is it seems to me, and the Franciscan philosopher Logan Gage has written a lot on this, if you're interested in this question on the divine attributes and how much Newman can get out of these arguments, and he makes this argument. He's a Baylor PhD who converted to Catholicism while at Baylor and is now chair of the philosophy department at Franciscan. Wonders never cease. The founders of Baylor. I don't know what they would think about this. And he argues that you actually need something like Aquinas' arguments to get a fuller account of the attributes. Newman would, I think, be fine with those as a complement. As you said earlier, he doesn't doubt their validity. What he wants is he wants only to engage people who are willing to seek and who are willing to examine their hearts honestly. Fine, you can talk about personal existence of God, but the interlocutor that he wants is somebody who's willing to admit, yeah, I have that experience of conscience. Right? So I don't think there's any problem on Newman's side with adding the five ways or versions of them. One of the other reasons that Newman's worried about those arguments is that in his own time, those were all connected with arguments for deistic conceptions of God. A God who is not active in history. So Newman says at one point, scripture is scenic. It tells us who God is by telling us what he does. A God active in history. I think of Pascal's line. Deism is almost as far from Christianity as atheism. I think Newman would affirm that. Okay, so that's my argument on Newman's side. I think Newman would be open, or should be open, his argument should be open to supplement from something like Aquinas' Five Ways in Natural Theology. What about on Aquinas' side? There's another place we have preambles. Aquinas doesn't call them preambles. The precepts of the natural law are both naturally known or knowable and revealed in the Decalogue, right? There's a strong overlap between the core content of the precepts of the natural law and the revealed law of the Decalogue. Duties to God, duties to neighbor. Very interesting what Aquinas says when he discusses the revelation of the law and why it was given when it was given. He says it was given when the natural law was being obliterated by an excess of sin. It says here, I hope you won't think he's a Lutheran for saying this. But he's got this element that's also in Newman that's about personal engagement of the law and an awareness of sin. To give such a law, God intended to give such a law as men by their own powers could not fulfill. So that, while presuming on their own powers, men might recognize themselves as sinners and, being humbled, might have recourse to the help of grace. That's almost exactly what Newman's talking about with conscience. An awareness of evil acts committed against an infinitely good God, and then an awareness of my impotence to make it right. God sent the law as a help, an auxilium, when the natural law, here's the quote, had begun to be obscured on account of the exuberance of sin. The old law was suitably given at the time of Moses as a remedy for human ignorance, and the old law partly aids by accusing. After man had been instructed by the law, his pride was convicted of his weakness through his being unable to fulfill what he knew. Here's Newman recognizing this in Aquinas. The natural law, this is Newman writing, the natural law, says St. Thomas, is an impression of the divine light in us, a participation of the eternal law in the rational creature. That's a direct quote from Aquinas. This law, back to Newman, as apprehended by the minds of individual men, is called conscience. And though it may suffer refraction in passing into the intellectual medium of each, it is not therefore so affected as to lose the character of being divine law, but still has, as such, the prerogative of commanding obedience. Aquinas talks about synderesis, this habit of the first principles, as synderesis is said to incite to good and to murmur at evil. Exactly what conscience does. Incites to good, and later he says this, Aquinas does about conscience. It witnesses, binds, or incites. It accuses, torments, and rebukes. So, my thesis about this division over the proper approach from nature to the divine, Aquinas emphasizing these metaphysical and natural theology arguments on the one hand, Newman emphasizing the more direct and personal route through conscience, is that they can be reconciled not only in the sense that they're complementary, but in the sense that I think Aquinas recognizes in his account of the precepts of natural law as preambles of the faith, exactly what Newman is saying about conscience and primitive religion. And that Newman, as further support for this, recognizes this in his own interpretation of Aquinas. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.